Welcome back to Mountain Money. As we discussed a couple of weeks ago when we had an interview with the book about American capitalism, railroads are rightly recognized as the critical industry that transformed the North American continent in the 19th century. But while that core technology may be a little old, the significance of railroads in the 21st century cannot be minimized. Each day, freight railroads move thousands of containers of goods across the country. Indeed, more than 13 million freight carloads were moved by the North American rail industry in 2017. Each such car can hold, among other alternatives, 470,000 bags of Fritos or 37,000 chickens, according to the American Railroad Association. That's a lot of cargo.
Gotta move those Fritos. But this 19th century industry faced massive 20th and 21st century management challenges. And apparently no one was better than Hunter Harrison at confronting those challenges. This morning, we have the chance to explore the career of Harrison with his biographer, Howard Green, the author of the book Railroader. He joins us on the phone this morning. Good morning, Howard Green. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, you two, and I loved your introduction. What a great way to describe and paint a picture of freight on rails. I wish I'd done that in the book.
Well, thank you for joining us. You know, you have a distinguished career in lots of business areas. It made me wonder, what was it that drew you to this particular project?
Amazing story. I mean, you know, I tell people that to write a book, you need at least one of three or four things. You need great character. Well, you can check the box on that one with Hunter Harrison. You need a plot. You can check that box with Hunter Harrison. You need issues. You can check that box. And what a context when you talk about railroads. You folks referred to this 19th century industry, which really, you know, when you looked at it in the late 1800s, when most of these railroads were initially built, it was the internet of its day, you know, connecting everybody. And, I mean, this guy, Hunter Harrison, was a bad kid growing up in Memphis. He was self-described bad kid, son of a cop. Needed to find himself. When he was 19, he got a job at the railroad yard in Memphis. The railroad was called Frisco. It's now part of Burlington Northern Santa Fe, which I gather runs through your neck of the woods there. And he started at the lowest of the low. He was pouring oil into the wheels of the axles of the rail cars, and he worked his way up, and he didn't really have a formal education, really only a high school diploma, a couple of years of college, which he dropped out of in Memphis, but he had an ability to see how railroads operated in multiple dimensions. He could move boxcars better than anybody. I mean, these rail yards would have thousands of boxcars, and they'd come in with one type of merchandise, and you'd have to move those cars to the other side of the rail yard. He likened it to high-level checkers, where, you know, you had 4,000 or 5,000 rail cars and you had to move them around fast, and he could do that better than anybody else. And he worked his way up in the system and developed, you know, along with other people, but he's the person who articulated it, something called precision-scheduled railroading, which was his operating philosophy and for which he's known worldwide. And it's hard to believe, but as late as the 1980s and into the 90s, freight railroads in North America did not run on schedules. They ran when the customer showed up with the shipment, like the lumber yard or you know, the coal mine would show up with, you know, a boxcar of coal, or the lumber yard would show up with a boxcar of lumber or whatever. And then the freight train would leave. Well, he thought, you know, this is absolutely ridiculous. If we ran an airline and we only took off when the passengers arrived for the flight, we'd never make any money. So he turned the model upside down. He was also a very controversial guy. He was an in-your-face kind of guy. He never backed down from a fight. He was rough and tough. These were command and control operations, and he was the commander.
Now, the subtitle of your book, Railroader, says The Unfiltered Genius and Controversy of Four-Time CEO Hunter Harrison. You've described a little bit his unfiltered genius, and you've talked a little bit about his management style. Talk about the controversy. Why was he controversial?
Sure. Well, the unfiltered is because I'll mention that first. He could only tell the truth. He was hardwired to only tell the truth and to say what was on his mind, unfiltered. And there's a lot of salty language in the book, too. His wife, when she read it, said, oh, more than 50 years, me and my girls never heard that kind of language. You know, it was the Southern gentleman. He wouldn't say those kinds of things around women. But he was highly controversial. He ran four railroads. He was CEO of four publicly traded companies, four railroads, Illinois Central, two up here in Canada, Canadian National and Canadian Pacific, and at the end of his career, CSX, the big U.S. railroad that runs up on the east side of the Mississippi, up the eastern seaboard. And, you know, as I said, he never backed down from a fight. He took on the unions. Railroads were hidebound places that hadn't changed in many, many years. You know, they were 18. You know, they were 19th century businesses. They were heavy on assets, long-lived assets. And he said, you know, just because you own an asset doesn't mean it's free. You have to maintain it. And that included locomotives. That included track. You know, you didn't want to have a piece of track just to store rail cars if a mile of track cost you $1 million, 15 years ago, more now. He got rid of locomotives. He changed the schedules on railroads. He changed the hours, the shifts. You know, he took people on, and he not only took on the employees of the railroads to try to change the culture of those organizations, which he thought was the biggest thing, to change the culture, but he took on the boards of directors. And frankly, those were the people who hired him to do the job, but he didn't have a heck of a lot of time for boards of directors because they don't know how to run a railroad. They're there for oversight. And so he clashed constantly. He clashed with the workers. He clashed with the, you know, the boards of directors and so forth. The only people who he didn't really clash with were shareholders. He made a lot of money for shareholders, including none other than Bill Gates, who continues to be the biggest shareholder of Canadian National. He owns the legal limit of Canadian National, which is 15%, $10, $12 billion worth of railroad.
You know, much has been written in recent business books about the relative obligations to the various stakeholders in major corporations, the employees, yeah, the customers, the boards. It sounds as though Harrison was someone who would rather have a rather unilateral view of what the corporation's job in society is, which is he was a maximize shareholder value kind of guy, wasn't he?
He was. You're absolutely right. We live in a stakeholder world, and people who work very closely with him, a fellow who manages one of the biggest pension funds in this country, was the chief financial officer of Canadian National, and he talked about that. When I great admiration for Hunter, who mentored and coached many, many people, thousands and thousands of people. He was a great teacher, but he did see everything through the lens of shareholder value. He said, you know, these businesses would not exist if there weren't the owners. And so the owners are the shareholders, and he did his utmost to satisfy those shareholders. He had little time for politicians. Optics were not his thing. And in fact, Paul Tellier, who was the CEO of Canadian National, a legendary figure in his own right here. He really ran the Canadian government under Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, a Secretary of the Cabinet, a most senior position in the government other than Prime Minister. He said, you know, Hunter was absolutely awful at government relations. He said this to me on the record. You know, he'd go into the office of the Minister of Transport, which is like your Secretary of Transportation, and he'd tell the person, you don't know what you're talking about. He couldn't believe it. Or Tellier told me that the majority leader, the U.S. Senate, phoned him, and Hunter told him, don't call him back. He's just going to ask for something. You know, he had laser-like focus, and that laser-like focus was running the railroad more efficiently for shareholders.
But that laser-like...
So I think you put your finger on it.
That laser-like focus and what I'll tactfully call the lack of diplomacy, that certainly had to have some negatives. How did that cost his business ventures, if at all?
How did that cost his, pardon me?
His business success. Where did this not work for him, this take charge style?
Well, you know, mostly it did work. I mean, he had another side to him, which was very charming, very generous. He was very funny. He could preach in front of a crowd of hundreds of people without notes for 8 hours on end. People were, you know, just, you know, dumbfounded by that ability and in awe of him. And he taught, as I said. He led so-called hunter camps, which were retreats where he would choose people from the railroad that he thought had leadership potential, and he singled them out, and he nurtured them. So, you know, that was one side. But where it didn't work, and back to your question, is in his final years at Canadian National at CN, which was hugely successful. I mean, that company is now worth approximately 40 times what it was worth when it went public in 1995. He came in 1998 when CN bought Illinois Central and to create a so-called NAFTA railroad, you know, the two countries, and to take advantage of trade. And Hunter was chief operating officer, and then he became CEO for 6 years, and he really pushed it. He put the pedal to the metal, and by the end, the board of directors grew weary of him. And there was a very acrimonious end to his time at Canadian National, even though he had created enormous shareholder value and taught them all how to run a railroad. He ticked off the board, and he thought they wanted him to stay on longer. They say, no, that wasn't the case. And there was a crossing of wires at the end, and there was a terrible fight at the board. And he left in 2009, retired. The public didn't know that there was a big fight at the board level. I didn't find out about it until later. And he kind of stewed for a couple of years on his horse farms. He hated not working, and it was a very bad ending for him there. And he was bitter about it until really... well, the last conversation I had with him was 10 days before he died last December, and it was still in his – we still talked about it. He bruised, and even though he was rough and tough, he felt those bruises deeply. Very sensitive guy, funnily enough. But it didn't – you know, to your point, it didn't work there at the end.
You know, the sense – one of the senses I got out of the book was that, like other senior business leaders that I've encountered – he approached subordinates in what I would call a binary way. Either you were worth having around or you weren't. And those who were worth hanging around, he mentored. And those who weren't, he ignored or got rid of. Is that a fair picture?
That is a totally fair picture. You were either on board or you weren't. And, you know, if you screwed up once, you know, he'd give you another chance because he felt he got second chances in his career. And he did. And where would he be if he hadn't been given a second chance? But he had very limited patience. You know, he didn't like the phrase "patience is a virtue." He said, "I hate that." you know, he also said, "I'm a bad loser, and I haven't mellowed with age." You know, another line was, "I go to work madder than hell, and I come home madder than hell." You know, he let you know what was on his mind. But you're right; it was binary. And if you bought in, if you were one of those people who showed a desire to learn, a desire to succeed, then he was on your side. He would teach you. He might beat you up, but then he would prop you up afterward. You know, he didn't just beat you down. If you wanted to learn, he might, you know, he might growl and stuff, but then he'd take you out to dinner, tell you some incredible story. He's a fantastic storyteller. So, you know, those who got on board, those were who were willing to learn, prospered from him. And, you know, binary is a great word. I mean, I use the word polarizing. He was a polarizing leader. And I get notes from people who've read the book or don't want to read the book because he was, you know, viewed in certain ways. And there are those who say, you know, if it weren't for him, I wouldn't have put my kids through college with my gains on the stock in the railroad or paid off my mortgage. And others, you know, the view is 180 degrees in the other direction. He wrecked my life. So binary is a good word.
So we were talking before the show and kind of jokingly asked each other, what would Hunter Harrison say about work-life balance?
That's a great question. Balance? What the hell are you talking about? You know, look, he loved his family. He often worked from home, from the family home in Florida, or the farm in Connecticut, farm in Florida as well. Family was, but he traveled a lot. They moved 18 times, maybe 20 times after you add in the Canadian moves and the final move to CSX. And, you know, his work came first, and he worked, from sun up till midnight. And, you know, you'd get, you know, I've got a friend who worked closely with him, among others, and, you know, it was not out of the realm to get an email or a call. He didn't email, a call, 3 a.m, you know, if there was something up. You know, this guy was always on it. And, Jeannie, his wife, spoke very candidly in the book, you may recall. I mean, she talked about how, she was frustrated that he wouldn't stop working. He kept working until just days before he died. He went to work for CSX while attached to an oxygen machine because of a very severe lung condition that necessitated the use of supplemental oxygen more than the last year of his life. And you know, he just couldn't stop working. So there really wasn't a work-life balance. It was work, work, work. I mean, he was heavily into the horse scene, the equestrian scene, the show jumping scene. But again, he treated it like he treated the railroad. He had to be the best. He was that way with golf. He had to be the best. It was just wired in that kind of way. And I think Jeannie, you know, she had a resentment. I mean, that was the word she used, he continued working and to run another railroad for this, you don't need the money, but he just couldn't stop.
I guess I wondered whether a woman, say a Carly Fiorina or a Sheryl Sandberg, could have been successful using the kinds of management approaches that Harrison used. What do you think?
That's a really good question, and I don't know the answer. Women get criticized for adopting stronger male-like or characteristics associated with command and control, male-like behavior. So I don't know. That's a very good question. I think it would be better to ask those kinds of people, a Sheryl Sandberg or a Carly Fiorina, and for their frank assessments of that, because I can't judge the reaction. I suspect it would be more difficult for them.
I guess one more thing I wanted to touch on before we left, which is we his signature was this precision scheduled railroading. And in some ways, as I was reading about it, it kind of reminded me of what Fred Smith did to the packaging industry, which was, I'm going to standardize things by sending them all through Memphis. It seems as though what Harrison did was to do something that must have had a significant impact on his customers. The customers were probably used to getting their stuff shipped when they wanted. Talk a little bit about that conflict between Harrison and the customers when he said, I'm going at such and such a time, get your stuff here or else.
Yeah. You know, again, I think you've highlighted something that was pretty critical. He told a story at one of the hunter camps when he worked for Burlington Northern Santa Fe after the Frisco was taken over by BN in 1980. They had stickers up all over the railroad that said, the customer's always right. And he joked to this group at the hunter camp at CN that he went around ripping those stickers off the wall. He didn't feel that a customer was always right. He quoted the character in the Steve Jobs biopic. I forget who played the role, but, you know, if somebody tells you the customer's always right, odds are it's the customer. And so he felt that, and it goes back to the airline. If we ran an airline and only took off when the customers showed up, we wouldn't make any money. So he was very much about reading the riot act to the customers. And this is when the train's going to go. And this is when you're going to have your stuff here, to at the terminal to be shipped. And there was a lot of conflict at CN, about customers, even at CP when he went. And it's tricky. You know, in Canada, you got two major railroads. So it's an oligopoly. and arguably in the United States with five Class 1 railroads, four big ones, one smaller one, Kansas City Southern, you again have an oligopoly. So, you know, on the other hand, you do have the competition from trucking, and trucks took a lot of business from the railroads when Eisenhower built the interstate in the 50s. And the railroads have been trying to get that back ever since. But you're right. He did irritate customers. On the other hand, he did make trains run faster. They ran longer trains. You know, there was a time when CN would quote a train from Vancouver to Chicago somewhere 7 to 11 days. And he said, forget that. We're going to quote it in hours. And then when you quote in hours, everything tightens up. And the trains move a heck of a lot faster than they used to, the freight trains. So customers do get what they want to get somewhere faster than they used to. They just don't necessarily get to send it when they want. So that's the difference with Hunter.
We've been talking to Howard Green. He's the author of Railroader, The Unfiltered Genius and Controversy of Four-Time CEO Hunter Harrison. You've written a lot of business books. You've been a journalist for 33 years. Tell us, who is the audience for this book? Who's getting it for Christmas?
You know, that's a good question. I think there's first of all, I think it should be a movie. It's
and
an
who would play
story.
Who would play the character? Who'd play Hunter Harrison?
Michael Douglas.
Michael Douglas, is that who you think?
Yeah.
A younger
no,
Michael Douglas?
Tommy Lee Jones.
Even better.
Yeah.
If you know him, let him know. I want to get the book to him. but there are others. He didn't live far from Hunter down in Florida. He was a horse guy, a polo guy. And I was trying to get limo drivers to tell me where he lived so I could slip him, you know, a note. I was unsuccessful. But, you know, I think there are a lot of people who could play him. But, look, I think there's obviously a business audience, an investor audience. I think there are people who, you know, I'm always amazed. There are people who pick up books. And I'm reading a book about Canada's North right now, and it's not a book that I would normally read, but I'm fascinated by it. I got onto it because a buddy of mine I played tennis with was the editor of it, and so I'm reading it. So I think, you know, if a book is good, and I hope this one is good, I think you'll be drawn to it just because the story is so fascinating and the character is so fascinating. Even if you're not given to reading business books, even if you're not given to reading about railroads, I think obviously there's an embedded railroading audience here and business audience. But I think the general reader would find it very interesting because this is an incredible life. This was an incredible life from soup to nuts, you know, right up until he passed away. You know, he was at it, and his, what happened in his childhood, he knew Elvis, all of those kinds of things. I almost feel like it's a nonfiction novel in a way. His life is just so rich in stories and in anecdote and in lessons and in controversy and in issues, whatever you think of him, whether you come down as pro-Hunter or anti-Hunter, there's an amazing story in there, and I hope it gets out to a broader audience.
Well, Howard Green, we thank you for taking the time to share your story about the book with us today. Have a great day. Howard Green, author of Railroader.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And speaking of interesting